La 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 la. Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? Mr. President, were you a lonely boy?
Were you a lonely boy?
Were you a lonely boy? How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave a road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay? I can only imagine what the First Lady has to say. You've come a long way.
Never take a walk with me. Would you?
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Lindsay Bernstein interviewing Rachel Godsill about getting over racial anxiety. Rachel shows how the unconscious associations and attitudes that we have towards people of different racial groups can affect the way we behave and talks about what we can do to relieve some of this anxiety.
All I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is Rachel Godsell, Research Director of the Perception Institute, a national consortium of behavioral science researchers and legal scholars who study how our perceptions of race affect every aspect of society. Rachel is the co-author of The Science of Equality, Volume 1, Addressing Implicit Bias, Racial Anxiety, and Stereotype Threat in Education and Healthcare. It's a new report about how implicit bias, racial anxiety, and stereotype threat contribute to Black people getting treated worse at school, at the doctor's office, and on the streets of a country where most people believe racism is wrong, but where a lot of people still act racist, often without realizing it. And do you guys do programming in addition to putting out reports and, you know, knowledge on the internet and that kind of stuff? I mean, do you go out and do workshops and that kind of stuff as well?
Yes. So I've actually been on a barnstorming tour through various states doing trainings with judges.
Mm-hmm.
So Delaware and Tampa is coming up soon, and New York and New Jersey and Cleveland. And then we do work with healthcare providers, some educational institutions. We're beginning to talk to those who are involved in, again, sort of culture creation in the media.
Fascinating. What do you guys do with the judges?
So this is something that I've done in my kind of crossover role as law professor and director of the Perception Institute. What I have been doing is working with the National Association of State Court Judges, and they have a program of doing implicit bias trainings, and they invited me to be one of their implicit bias trainers. I've altered the training somewhat to include the concepts racial anxiety and stereotype threat that we talk about in the report. And so I've been giving essentially three-hour interactive lectures with the judges that include some discussion of how to apply these insights to their particular context. So the family court judges, for example, talk about the ways that implicit bias may be affecting their decisions. I help them think through what are the intervention points where they may be able to use these insights to alter the dynamics and prevent the racially disparate outcomes from occurring.
How long has the Perception Institute been around?
Perception Institute is actually a renamed version of what consortium that started in 2008 called the American Values Institute. And that consortium was founded in fall of 2008 while the Obama campaign was at a low ebb and racial anxiety appeared to be a significant potential feature in how voters might be making their decisions in the presidential election. And our concern wasn't partisan per se, but rather to bring social scientists together to think about the way that race may be affecting people's voting decisions. And so it formed at that point, and we chose the name American Values Institute because with the basic idea that it's a core American value that, you know, race and ethnicity and perceptions of religion, et cetera, shouldn't be undermining or sort of interfering with people's decisions about who they're going to vote for, particularly in an important election, like the presidential election, but obviously in any election. So the mind scientists were looking for ways to address what seemed to be this undercurrent of anxiety, and the idea of implicit bias seemed the most relevant because, you know, very few people would say, and very few people I think thought, I'm not going to vote for Barack Obama because he's Black. And in fact, when some of the surrogates for the Obama campaign outright said to some, you know, sort of voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and other states, sort of, if you're worried about voting for Barack Obama because of his race, you know, think about his campaign promises and how helpful he'll be to all the issues that we care about. And that was a great affront to the people to whom that was said, understandably so, because they felt like they were being called racist. And so what the implicit bias allowed us to do is to understand how people could simultaneously feel oddly ambivalent about Barack Obama and be worried that he might be a Muslim or feel like they didn't know him despite all the incredible amount of exposure he'd gotten in the course of the campaign, and still be very affronted and upset if someone suggested that race was the reason for their ambivalence.
So tell me about the report.
So the report is a result of several years of work, and because the organization, in some sense, was created with the idea of sharing with the public how important this concept of implicit bias is, and by implicit bias I mean the automatic associations and attitudes people often have toward different identity groups. So in other words, you know, most of us are committed to the idea of equality and committed to the idea that racism is wrong and committed to the idea that gender ethnicity shouldn't affect, you know, who receives what job, etc. But because we live in a culture in which race and ethnicity and gender and other identity categories continue to be associated with all sorts of stereotypes, our conscious commitment to those values is not often predictive of what we actually do. What's fascinating is it turns out that our unconscious associations and attitudes, and the difference between the two is the attitude is how you feel about someone, whether you like them, whether you don't like them, whether you feel warm or cold, and associations are sort of the traits that you associate with them. So our associations and attitudes with different groups tend to be more predictive of how we actually behave, so how we make decisions and how we relate to people interpersonally. So implicit bias seemed critically important, and that was our initial focus of all of our work. But one of the co-authors of the report, Phil Goff, does a lot of work with police departments. And one of the findings in his research with police departments trying to identify the causes for excessive uses of force was that neither implicit bias nor explicit bias actually predicted which police officers were most likely to engage in excessive force against African-American and Latino young men. Instead, whether or not the police officer had masculinity ambivalence, mm-hmm. whether or not the police officer was worried that he or she, generally he, would be seen as racist.
How did they measure uses of force? Did they look at people's records retrospectively?
Yes. They looked at field data, looking at records retrospectively, and they also did sort of in-house training modules that they use generally, but they designed these explicitly to test how people would respond to different people on the street with varying racial identities. So that finding, which is not in this report, he's still continuing his study and he's still gathering his findings, and this report is obviously focused on education and health, but that finding sort of opened our eyes to the idea that just focusing on implicit bias was not enough, and that in fact, if we focus just on implicit bias, and a lot of lawyers were sort of at the point of great excitement about how relevant this idea might be and suggesting, you know, all jurors should take the implicit association test, which is a test that you can take if you go online and look and Google Project Implicit, and you can take an actual kind of online test that measures your implicit bias, you know, against African Americans, against Latinos, against Muslim Americans, against all sorts of groups. So lawyers were starting to get excited about the idea, you know, let's use the implicit association test for prospective jurors or for prospective employees, prospective teachers. And what Phil's finding made us think about is, first of all, implicit bias may not be the determinant of things that are critically important, like which police officers are apt to be engaged in excessive use of force.
Can we take a step back and, sure. and talk a little bit about the history of the idea of implicit bias, where this came from within the science?
Yeah, so the idea of implicit bias, in some sense, you know, we can take all the way back to Freud and the role of the unconscious, but what's absolutely different about our current understandings of how the brain works from Freud's understanding is that Freud assumed that what was in our unconscious was individual and personal, mm-hmm. and often, you know, sort of strangely sexual and neurotic. But it turns out what's in our unconscious are all the social categories and what scientists call schema of how the world operates that's actually shared among us. So we learn about what an object is, for example, or we learn about what gender is as children, and that is locked in our brain, and we don't never have to think about it again.
What you say, what I see, 100 kids in the street, like the cops on the block, 100 kids on the beat, fireworks in the night, it makes it harder to sleep, bombs burst in the air like Francis Scott Key, they got me, fearing the tank and the Glock, fear that justice is injustice, fear the shank in the block, fear that I'll get shot, and plus some bullets ain't rubber, they try and destroy our families, our cousins and brothers, but we won't let them, we won't succumb to oppression, so we combat Israeli aggression with rocks as a weapon, and I feel threatened, just to walk out of my home, not knowing if I'll make it past the corner, walking alone, that's why I'm dropping these poems, off the top of my dome, ancestors. Flamethrowers, not some rolling stones. Never hold the chrome, still they hold their own. I'm trying to elevate my people to a whole other zone. So where we going, not down, our direction is top. Keep on doing what we doing and we ain't gonna stop. Through this consciousness and activism plus hip hop, we gon' stay working for the cause and grind around the clock. Used to serve on my flock, the promises of peace. Until we get our peace, there ain't gonna be peace. Until I rest beneath the earth, I will not quit it. I'm a Philistine, so you know I got to get it. B-dub, rag top, I am chic, stay committed. This one's a hot one, and them Arab boys did it. Rise up from the struggle. Go through the rubble of bulldozers. Don't give up until this bullshit's over.
And now back to Lindsay Beierstein interviewing Rachel Godsill.
So would we have biases that are true as well? I mean, I have a concept of apples and I associate apples with being delicious. Is that a bias as well?
That would be an association. I don't think we'd call it a bias unless basically when you use the word bias in a sense mean either a positive bias, a preference, or a negative bias, which would be a prejudice. So if we're neutral, then again, that's sort of a valence or an analysis of whether something is sort of good or bad. Mm-hmm. But an association doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. And having implicit associations essentially allows us to operate in the world. You know, we have to have these categories. And we likely are always going to have stereotypes or associations about categories of people. The question is whether or not the categories or schema are accurate, and sometimes they're wildly inaccurate, sometimes they're reasonably accurate, and sometimes they're somewhere in the middle. So we're always going to have those because, again, our brain needs them to function. But the question is, where do they come from and what do we do with them? And it's also interesting to think about how they change over time.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so the stereotypes that people in the beginning of the 20th century had about the Irish, for example, and I'm Irish, so I tend to use examples involving the Irish quite a bit. The Irish were seen, you know, in England and some parts of the United States as absolutely sort of savage and, you know, sort of uncultured, and, you know, Irish need not apply in Boston, for example. In our present day, that idea seems kind of silly and quaint because it's so far from our current reality.
Yeah.
But in its time, the stereotypes about the Irish were actually, you know, quite deeply held and very quite pervasive. So how we think about categories of people is cultural and, again, can change over time. And it's just interesting to see which categories have changed and which have remained much more intractable.
I mean, the idea of race itself is a relatively novel idea as we understand it today, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's in some sense the idea of race as being kind of black or white, the idea that there only are a couple of races, you know, sort of black, white, Asian, that's entirely new. And it used to be in earlier eras that each ethnic group in Europe was a different race. So race in some sense has become much more simplified and, you know, sort of more binary in our current time. But at the same time, it's also more fluid. So one thing that's kind of interesting about the way implicit biases work, they tend to be much less significant just based upon how someone self-identifies and more significant how much one can be easily said to resemble the group. So someone who's a light-skinned African-American is going to experience the world often quite differently now than someone who's dark-skinned, whereas that wouldn't have been so true in the 50s. So again, that's another way that all this has changed. The report itself had the idea of bringing together this concept of implicit bias and why it's important, but adding to it this idea of racial anxiety. And when we use the phrase racial anxiety, we don't mean what social scientists call racial threat,
mm-hmm.
as in, you know, the demographics are changing and whites have anxiety that they're going to lose power. Social scientists call that racial threat. When we say racial anxiety, what we mean is something very, very different, which is the concern that people have either in anticipation of or during an interracial interaction that their race or the perceptions about them because of race are going to make that interaction awkward or difficult. And so people of color often will be concerned when they're in an interracial interaction that they'll be subject to bias. But what's not necessarily recognized as much is whites are often very concerned that they will be presumed to be biased or to be racist in an interracial interaction. And what's important to understand is that anxiety often causes those interactions to go exactly as badly as people fear that they would. So if a person of color is worried they're going to be judged by someone through a biased lens and the white person worries they're going to be perceived as biased, both will be more awkward, less eye contact, more distance. Cortisol goes up, the sort of stress reaction in people's bodies is heightened. They have a little bit of shutdown because when we're anxious, we're not able to behave the way we normally do. And so racial anxiety turns out to actually be really important in specifically the kinds of institutions that we focus on in the report, schools and hospitals.
Interesting.
So, we give a lot of information in the report that's not entirely new about very, very otherwise seemingly inexplicable outcomes in healthcare. You know, African-American women are far more likely to, you know, die of breast cancer than white women, even when we control for insurance, even when we control for poverty, even when we control for college, you know, and education rates. Well, why would that be so? Some of it may be implicit bias on the part of doctors, but the social science suggests that some of it is also probably racial anxiety, which leads the interaction between white doctors and African-American patients to be shorter, to not elicit as much information, and to elicit less trust on the part of the patient, all of which affect the ultimate success of care. So, and then if you think about teachers, and a racially anxious teacher, as we describe in the report, is less likely to give the necessary critical feedback that students need to do well. And in fact, there's a study that we describe in the report where middle school teachers were sent intentionally poorly written essays, and when they were given information about the race and ethnicity and gender of the supposed student they were responding to the essay, of course, it's all the same essay. The teachers who thought that their students were black or Latino gave less critical feedback than they did if they thought the student was white or Asian. They gave more feedback, critical feedback. You know, you need to improve here, or this sentence is awkwardly phrased, or this idea needs more elaboration. And that was so, except for those teachers who felt like they had the support of their principals, who felt supported in their institutions, those teachers gave the same level, the same kind of critical feedback to Black students.
So did they measure the racial anxiety on the part of the teachers too? Did they find that less racially anxious teachers were more likely to give the critical feedback?
In that study, they didn't use an instrument to measure racial anxiety. We know that there are areas where we need to do more research, and that's definitely some research we hope to do. In that study, the way the researcher and Kent Harbor at Rutgers University was the lead researcher on that paper, his conclusion that the different levels of feedback were a result of anxiety about being thought of as racist, so it's basically the same concept, his conclusion is based upon the fact teachers who talked about their feeling of belonging within their institution and whether they would have support from their colleagues and principals, those teachers gave equal levels of critical feedback to Black students as they did to white students, whereas teachers who didn't feel like they had support within their institutions gave lower levels of critical feedback to Black students. Both sets gave lower levels of critical feedback to Latino students. So what that suggests is the teachers do have some implicit biases about kind of writing capacity of Latino students, but it wasn't implicit bias that caused the teachers to give different levels of critical feedback to Black students. It was worry that they would be seen as racist. And again, this is an extrapolation from the findings, and more work needs to be done. But in a sense, that's really the only explanation that makes sense.
Yeah.
If teachers feel like their principals support them and back them, respond differently to the same essay as teachers who don't.
Can you see this sort of creating a spiral of lesser achievement where teachers are not giving people the feedback that they need to improve, and therefore they're not improving as much as everyone would like them to and as much as they're capable of?
Absolutely. And in addition to students not being given critical feedback and therefore, you know, not learning what they need to do to improve, students, it turns out, are sort of genius at perceiving when they're being given false praise.
Mm-hmm.
Students feeling or concerned that they're getting false praise or that they're not being given feedback when essentially they think they in some ways ought to have been given feedback actually disengage from school as much or more than students who feel like their teachers are biased. So again, another reason why we think it's so important to understand the role of racial anxiety and what we call white stereotype threat as implicit bias. And, you know, the good news is these are fixable. So teachers can be taught how to give effective interracial constructive criticism that will balance between triggering the concern on the part of the student that the teacher is biased, because, of course, there are teachers who are biased, and there, you know, there are employers who are biased, and the study describes an example of law firm partners who do, in fact, find, you know, more typographical errors when they think a memo is being written by someone Black than they do when someone's white, and who actually perceive the memo to be less well-written when they think the person is Black than white. So bias, of course, continues to exist, and so it's kind of, you know, you're between a rock and a hard place if you're a student of color or if you're a person of color in the workplace. If on the one hand you're wondering, am I getting this negative feedback because someone's biased? On the other hand, if you don't get a negative feedback, am I not getting any critical feedback because this person, you know, has racial condescension? And so Claude Steele, who's a brilliant social psychologist who's done a lot of the work in identifying this idea of stereotype threat, what he has done studies on is essentially how those who want to give interracial feedback can do so to answer the concern that a person of color might have on either end. And the way that that's done is to expressly invoke high expectations. So to state very explicitly, I have very high expectations for you, then to explain specifically why you think that person is capable of meeting those high expectations, giving examples, and then give all the critical feedback that person needs to hear in order to improve. And when that kind of, you know, what he calls wise feedback or wise criticism is given, students of color don't have to worry that they're being judged through kind of a biased lens because they're being held to high expectations, and that feels good. That feels like they're being respected. But they're also being given all the critical feedback that they need to be able to improve and to avoid the negative spiral that you described.
There's this conventional wisdom in social justice circles that those of us, you know, all the people, everybody in some sense, but, you know, people who have more privilege should be constantly reflecting on it and checking their own privilege and being really aware of the fact that they might be overstepping, they might be doing something wrong. In light of this research, is that actually a productive way to go about it?
Absolutely not. It's a great question. So the idea of white privilege is complicated, or the idea of class privilege, because, of course, if you're an upper-middle-class white person, you have all sorts of privilege, and that's absolutely true. You know, you have the privilege of not ever being subjected to, you know, the bias on the street that someone of color has. You have the privilege, if you're upper middle class, of having all of the creature comforts that those of us who are upper middle class do. You know, for some people, you can go through the exercise of recognizing that privilege and then move on and still be kind of authentic and not filled with crippling anxiety and guilt when you interact with a person of color. But for a lot of people, the check the privilege or the white privilege idea either makes them feel resentful, particularly if they're understood to have white privilege, but they're lower middle class or working class, where life feels pretty hard, and it doesn't feel like there's a lot of privilege going on. So that can trigger kind of resentment among someone who doesn't, in fact, have the class privilege, particularly when they see someone having class privilege, and they don't feel like that's being recognized as much as white privilege. But even, you know, for someone who legitimately could be said to have white privilege, recognizing your privilege alone doesn't really do any work. So ironically, when we're told to identify white privilege, it's so that we recognize what we have, and that allows us to look beyond ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I think often it stops with ourselves.
My fellow Americans, I know that you've been scared, you know, frightened about this whole economy thing, the whole financial thing. But it's taken care of. You know, I was working. We passed a federal bailout for a mere $700 billion. I was working around the clock with members of the House of Representatives, House of the Congress, House of the Senate, House of Pancakes, and the House, the White House. Basically, we got together for a bunch of house parties, and we got it all taken care of. I know that you may be worried that these are uncertain times, but uncertain times call for uncertain leadership. Perhaps I can better explain it through this. Well, they say I've let the USA start to run amok. We spent way too much money, and now with the bill you're stuck. It's all because some bankers ruined our economy. Now I'm out here hoping that you all won't blame it all on me. Should've gone to freecreditreport.com. I could've seen those Wall Street guys were a bunch of ticking bombs. We could've checked their credit and seen that their loans don't work. Instead, we end up bailing out a bunch of greedy jerks. Yeehaw!
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.